This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. My guest today is Dr. Jessica Clarko, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jessica is the author or co-author of four books, including Qualitative Literacy, A Guide to Evaluating Ethnographic and Interview Research with Mario Small, published by the University of California Press in 2022. Negotiating Opportunities, How the Middle Class Secures Advantages in School, Oxford University Press, 2018, and A Field Guide to Grad School, Uncovering the Hidden Curriculum, Princeton University Press, 2020. Clark was here to discuss her latest book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net, which is scheduled for release June 4th, 2024, with Portfolio Penguin. Today on The Annex, the many ways American society traps women and sells myths that harm women and their families. Stay with us. All right. Well, Dr. Jess Clarko, welcome to the Annex. So good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, Jess, you bring together a lot of data in this book, as well as drawing on the work of other scholars who discuss concepts and processes like intersectionality, neoliberalism, care work, and linked fates, among other things. And among these concepts you develop, perhaps two stand out as a through line. First, the DIY society and the motherhood trap. Could you unpack those for us to start?
Sure. So when I talk about a DIY society in the book, I'm essentially talking about a society where people are expected to manage their own risks with little or no support from the government. And in practice, that means things like low taxes, especially on wealthy people and corporations, little or no regulation of industry, a kind of emphasis on corporate profits, and limited investment in things like the social safety net for supporting people in managing the risks of their day-to-day lives. And so since the 1930s, as I talk about in the book, corporate elites and their cronies have essentially tried to promote this kind of DIY model as an alternative to the kind of social safety net that many other countries enjoy. We can trace this back to kind of reaction to the New Deal and to efforts to try to bring in these neoliberal ideologies that were being developed at the time as a way to push us in a different direction and wrap those in many cases in propaganda campaigns, things like General Electric Theater, which was a television program hosted by Ronald Reagan, that was used to kind of promote this model of society, this idea that we don't actually need a social safety net because we can take care of ourselves, and maybe even a little bit more perniciously, that we'd actually be better off without a social safety net because in the absence of one, we're actually more likely to make those good choices that will keep us safe. And so that's kind of this idea of the DIY society that is kind of the foundation for many of the social policies that we've pursued as a country, particularly over the last century. And in terms of the motherhood trap, so what I'm talking about here is it's one of the key mechanisms that the U.S. uses to force women into exploitation. And so kind of the key argument of the book is that the U.S. has managed to weather the challenges of trying to be a DIY society, because you can't really DIY society. We need support from each other. We need support from the government. But we've managed to make it look possible by pushing a lot of the risk and responsibility that comes with that DIY society onto women to manage instead. And I talk in the book about how, you know, this kind of exploitation can hit many different people in many walks of life, but it disproportionately falls onto mothers, and particularly mothers of young children, because in the absence of things like universal paid leave, universal affordable childcare, and in the presence of gender norms that treat women as the natural best caregivers for children, mothers of young children can be easily forced into doing a disproportionate share of the unpaid and underpaid labor, and also into filling in gaps in our economy and gaps in our social safety net. So we know, for example, that women hold 70% of the lowest wage jobs in the U.S. economy, and that many of those are mothers of young children, in part because of punitive work requirements attached to our welfare system, and also in part because when you're a mother with young children with caregiving responsibilities, those jobs are often the kinds of underpaid jobs in the caregiving economy are often the best ones available to you, given the limited care options that we have. And so I talk in the book, for example, about one mom who I call Brooke, who actually never thought she was going to be a mom. She never wanted to be a parent, in part because she'd grown up in a family with a lot of volatility. Her parents were not in a happy relationship. And so she kind of said, I don't really ever want to have kids of my own. And yet she accidentally got pregnant in college and was planning to get an abortion. And her boyfriend's parents at the time even offered to pay, but then her own parents found out, and her mom persuaded her that she should keep the baby, that they would help her raise the child. But when push came to shove and when she ultimately had the baby, her parents weren't able to follow through the way that they had promised initially. And so Brooke ended up dropping out of college. She ended up on welfare. She ended up moving into a shelter because that was the best way that she could get on the list for subsidized housing. And ultimately she started off in a retail job, you know, because that was the best job open to her. And that's where many folks end up in these situations. And then ended up as a childcare worker. Because that was, you know, the next best option that was available to her. It came with free childcare for her son, but it wasn't a job that paid very well. It paid just above minimum wage. And even when she got promoted to the assistant director position at the center a few years later, she was still only making $25,000 a year. And so we can think about this sort of pathway of pushing women into motherhood, leaving them with limited options care-wise. And certainly she couldn't afford childcare. Part of the reason that she dropped out of college in the first place was that she couldn't afford childcare. And she didn't trust her family to provide care for her son, even if they could have. Both her parents were working full time during the day. And so it just wasn't an option. And so this is how we end up with women in these kinds of jobs in our economy that are often too labor intensive to be profitable. And so we need someone to fill them. And we can't, without government subsidies, afford to pay them well. And women, especially mothers of young children, end up filling in those gaps and also end up filling in gaps in the sort of unpaid labor that also has to be done at home.
I think this is a great segue to a story that you tell in your book on pages 48 and 49 that illustrate your own mother's situation of working in the home and eventually becoming an educator, thus pulling a triple shift. This is an example of how you and your family of origin are featured in the book. Can you talk about the choice to open up about your own family here?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm someone who, you know, on social media, I've always been pretty open about my own experiences with parenthood and kind of my own life in general. I think there's value in showing that the work that we do is often connected to or shaped by the kinds of experiences that we have in our personal lives. And certainly trying to normalize the idea of academic motherhood is something that I care a great deal about personally. Beyond that, I mean, I think it's hard for me to divorce this book from my experiences as a daughter and a mother and a caregiver for others, in the sense that, I mean, I wouldn't have started this project that became the book without the experiences I had in that sense. I was, you know, my early work was mostly ethnographic research in schools, but as a mom of two young kids and with the demands that involved, you know, doing another intensive ethnography wasn't going to be possible, at least at that stage of my career. And so I was looking for a project that I could do that was more team-based and more interview-based. And at the time I was also, you know, struggling with childcare challenges and lots of other things. And so I wanted to know, how do families navigate this? How do they navigate the discrepancies between their ideals for family life and the realities? And so that's part of what led me to do this research that started before the pandemic and then ultimately ended up involving pandemic work and pandemic-focused interviews with families too. And so I think it was kind of born out of these personal experiences. And then certainly I think there's a piece of it too, in the sense that my participants trust me with their stories. And so there's a certain, it feels only fair on some level to share a bit of my own life in the book to put that in context and to show how this resonated with me in the hope that it will resonate with readers as well.
I'm a fan of this kind of self-disclosure, I guess you would say, just because it does humanize the author as well, right? And the fact that you, as a person with a full-time job and these caregiving responsibilities and in the midst of COVID and all sorts of things. I remember you tweeting about this project during that time, which was a lengthy period, which I feel like we're still not fully through processing as a society, but also as a discipline and as higher education workers as well.
Yeah.
So chapter 3 drives home the point that we are all complicit in the system that exploits women's labor, even those who escape the motherhood trap. What are some of the consequences that even successful upper middle class women face, even if they do avoid that trap?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's important to start off here by acknowledging that our attempts to DIY society have really decimated American families and communities. And that's particularly true for low-income communities, and especially Black communities and Latino communities and other communities of color in the U.S. In those contexts, it is often very easy for women to get stuck filling in these gaps in our economy and in our social safety net, because I talk about in the book how we essentially leave them nowhere to turn for support because everyone everyone around them is struggling and oftentimes nowhere to hide when other people come to them looking for support in the process too, because they know that the people around them, their families, their communities, that they may be the best hope for other people around them. And also that there's risks to saying no. If they say no to someone who needs help right now, that the tables might turn and they might be the one who needs help down the line. And so I think, you know, that's where the crux of this really falls. And in that system, relatively privileged women do have it somewhat easier in that they can afford to offload some of the risk that they've been handed by dumping it in many cases onto others who are in more vulnerable positions than them. You know, things like, you know, paying for childcare, paying for house cleaning, paying for, you know, home health services for elderly family members, for example. At the same time, I mean, I think that we could think about the reason that work doesn't have to be exploitative, but it has to do with the fact that we keep it trapped in the private market as opposed to making it part of a universal system where people are able to access the care that they need and where care providers are able to do that work in a sustainable way that is valued and provides, you know, dignified wages and dignified benefits for that essential work that they're doing. But the benefit for relatively privileged women in the system is that they can offload some of this risk and responsibility. And research shows that the more that they're able to offload or the more that they're able to outsource, the easier it is for women to compete with men in the workplace and secure the kinds of salaries that also give them leverage to negotiate with their partners for support at home in many cases too. And so I think it's important to recognize that as context. And many of the women that we talked to who were in that more privileged position talked about the guilt that they felt about having, you know, being able to afford to outsource some of this kind of labor. But at the same time, feeling like if I don't do this, you know, I'm going to be in a much more precarious position and kind of feeling that tension. But I talked to one mom who just said, like, I feel like, you know, I'm in an okay place right now, but I also feel like it could change tomorrow. And so I feel like there's pressure to just like take whatever opportunities I can get and hoard them and sit on top. And so, I mean, I think it helps to speak to how many of us can be complicit in that kind of opportunity hoarding, given the inequalities and the precarity that we're up against. And to that end, I mean, I think part of the push that gets women to kind of get past that guilt of complicity is that even relatively privileged women, even if they can outsource some of the risk, are often still drowning, in part because the sort of our attempts to be this DIY society have left all but the wealthiest families among us with more responsibility than we can easily manage, even if we're outsourcing some of it. And because what's left over after that outsourcing often falls to women, even when men are available to fill in those gaps. And so I talk in the book, for example, about a mom that I call Virginia, who's a tenure-track professor at a leading research university, and she makes about $75,000 a year. Her husband, Charles, is a middle school math teacher, and he has a master's degree, and he's only making about $45,000 a year. So she's the clear breadwinner in the household, but she's also the one with the more flexible job. She can work from home. She can, you know, set her own schedule to a degree that her husband can't. And so she oftentimes ends up as the default parent. She's the one who ends up staying home with their kids when they get sick, or during COVID, she was the one, especially after her husband's school reopened, she was the one who kind of managed when her kids' preschool kind of kept shutting down repeatedly for COVID. And on top of that, she's also part of the sandwich generation. She's the one who kind of fills in the gaps for her elderly parents, particularly after her mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and was sort of unable to do a lot of the family caregiving and the family responsibilities and just day-to-day things that she'd previously taken care of. And Virginia talked about how in the context of their family, her dad and her brother could have taken on more, but it fell to her. And she recalled this one conversation with her brother that initially felt really sweet, but that ended up leaving her with a sort of sour taste in her mouth. She talked about how he, like, at a family gathering, like, sat down and gave her a big hug and told her, like, you know, I'm really sorry this happened, but it's all on you now. You're the matriarch and it's all on you. And she was like, oh, that's sweet. But then she's like, oh, wait, I don't know. Like, does it have to be all on me? Does it have to be that way? And so I think it pushes us to think about how we sort of allow women to be the default in these kinds of situations, even when they don't necessarily have to be, when there are others who could step up given the circumstances that they're in.
That story really hit home for me as someone who has had an academic job for a while and moved here and there. And the impacts on our family have been pretty significant. You know, I do have a spouse, and that person has done a lot to make my career possible and continues to do that. And so those of you who are academics reading the book, you will probably find a lot that resonates with you, whether you're a mother or a father or just anyone who's in a partnership in this society that really relies on a lot of exploitation because we've DIY'd it, you know, and actually called that freedom too, right? There's a notion that the definition of freedom is not relying on government support. in order to manage the riskiness of life, which everyone is subject to, but some more than others.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we mentioned COVID earlier, and you know, you did do some tweeting through the COVID pandemic. But what was it like to do this work in the midst of that pandemic when you had your own household tasks and caregiving responsibilities? I mean, I remember we have one child in our house, and there was Zoom school, and there was check-ins with teachers, and there was constant concern about masking and distancing. And folks were on top of each other that they wouldn't normally be if there was a schooling in person and so forth. So take us inside the process of this during the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, so my team and I had been in the field with this project since 2018. This originated as a study of sort of the best laid plans of parenting. I was interested in understanding how do families develop the ideas of the kinds of parents that they want to be, and then what happens when things don't go the way that they plan them to, and how do they cope with that? How are those ideas shaped by the people around them? And so in 2018 and 2019, I'd worked with a team of undergraduate and graduate students to recruit 250 pregnant people from prenatal clinics in Indiana. They all identified as women, so I talk about them that way. But we asked them a pretty extensive survey about all kinds of things that they planned to do with their new babies when they were born. And then we followed up with those same moms at 6 months and 12 months and 18 months postpartum. And so with both surveys and interviews about their experiences with parenting. And we were still in the field with those interviews and surveys when the pandemic hit in early 2020. And even with those kind of pre-pandemic kind of continuing project interviews, it became very apparent very quickly how much of an impact the pandemic was having on families with young children, and particularly on the moms within those families. In many of the couples that we talked to, couples didn't even talk about who would be the one to kind of sacrifice their paid work or their other responsibilities to care for the kids when childcare centers or schools shut down. It was just sort of moms by default, you know, as it often is in those kinds of situations. And certainly at the time, I mean, I had my own, my kids were 5 and 2 at the time. So my oldest was in kindergarten and my younger one was in childcare, and both, you know, their schools shut down. And so that was challenging on lots of fronts in the sense that at the time we were living in this relatively open plan house where there were no doors really on the first floor. And so my husband's office was on one side of the house with no doors. And then I was in the kitchen set up with my like standing desk at the countertop with no doors. And then there was a sort of kids play area in between. And so it was literally just like kids running circles behind us through Zoom calls for many, many months during the early pandemic. My team and I decided early on that we really needed to gather more data given the stories that we were hearing. And so we ended up going back to those original families that we'd been following and inviting them to participate in pandemic focused surveys and interviews. And it was, I kind of didn't expect much. I kind of expected that a few people would maybe be interested in talking to us. And it ended up being the most overwhelming response rate that I've ever gotten with any study I've ever fielded. And so really like everybody wanted to talk. And so I think we ended up doing, and certainly not everybody, but we ended up doing 65 interviews in 4 weeks. And so it was a time when it was a bonkers amount of data collection in kind of from mid-May or from mid-April through kind of mid-May of 2020. Wow. And so it was just this kind of intense level of data collection. And I was tremendously grateful to have a huge team of graduate students and other folks who were helping me to manage the project at the time and to carry out these interviews. The ones I was doing, the kids were often, you know, watching TV and I was holed up in the bedroom kind of with my headphones and my laptop. And so there were lots of moments that were a bit chaotic. And I was tremendously grateful to have support from a good team behind me to get this work done. And certainly would not have been possible without their support in the process because it was more than I could have managed on my own. Even though I think the experiences that I was having with my own kids at home made it feel particularly important to capture that moment in time and to get a sense of what families were going through as they were navigating those early COVID months.
We really get a sense in the book of women being pushed really to breaking points. I mean, motherhood trap is a term that has been used, but it feels even more intense than the word trap can kind of capture, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the moms that we interviewed talked about, like some of those early interviews, listening back to them, reading through the transcripts is emotionally challenging in the sense that these were moms who were talking about, I mean, maybe it seems funny, but like, you know, like hiding in the bathroom, eating a sleeve of Oreos to get a break from the stress of trying to navigate all of these things simultaneously, or on the flip side of things, sort of the deep fear and uncertainty around having family members who were in places that were hit hard during the early stages of the pandemic, and kind of losing family members. I mean, I think there was a lot of loss, there was a lot of hardship, there was a lot of fear and uncertainty, and certainly a lot of frustration with our sort of lack of support for families in those moments. And so it was a deeply challenging time particularly for families with young kids and often especially for the moms in those families.
Your book brought to mind, and you discuss in chapter 4, the success sequence. And contrary to what those success sequence writers would have us believe, better individual choices will not fix a broken system or save families and children from poverty. So I'm curious, why do you think that this false narrative has been so well promoted and is so popular? As you write on page 85, poverty and precarity are the primary reasons couples break up or avoid getting married in the first place.
I think there's a hopefulness that comes with these agency-based narratives that just promise people, I mean, there's a whole self-help industry, a multi-billion dollar industry that is founded on this idea that if you just make good choices, you will live a better life. You will have the kind of stability that you need. You will have the kind of security that you need. And it's an appealing idea at its core because it tells us that we can change things and that even when the odds are stacked against us, that we don't have to be hopeless. And I think that's part of where the appeal comes from. And that appeal has also been amplified by lots of kind of myth-making, some of those propaganda campaigns that we talked about briefly before in the sense of promoting this notion that if people just make good choices, they will be safer and the whole society will be safer. And I think it's also complicated in the sense that it's easy to assume that correlation is causation, even if that's not actually the case. And I think that's oftentimes what's really going on behind the scenes when it comes to things like the success sequence. You know, just go to college, just get married, just wait to have children. In reality, those kinds of what we often think of as good choices are disproportionately available to those who have the privilege to make them. And so it's oftentimes people's privilege and not really their choices that is driving those inequalities in people's outcomes. Even when it looks on the surface like, okay, all the people who made these choices are doing great. So if you just make those choices, you'll be doing great too. And so I think we have to be really careful about building advice on, you know, correlation as opposed to causation. And we have to think about, you know, who's benefiting from this kind of a model where people are expected to just make good choices without any real support to make the kinds of choices that even, you know, that may actually have some relationship to success, but only in the context of the resources that are necessary to make them.
It just occurred to me, this is like sampling on the dependent variable, right? So you just look at the so-called successful families and say, well, what did they do? It's like those articles that are like 5 tips from the top CEOs. It's like, well, okay, just because they wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning doesn't mean everyone who wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning is great. There are lots of bus drivers who wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, but they're not multimillionaires, you know?
Exactly.
Your book shows just how cruel our society often is. And I think that's an appropriate word, right? The work requirements for TANF, for example, don't allow recipients to count taking college classes as fulfilling their work requirement. That's obviously limiting the time caregivers have to advance their skills and potentially qualify for stable employment. That's cruel. But don't such requirements in general just beg the question, why do we force people, poor people, to work for benefits in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that we force poor people to work for benefits because it helps to maintain this illusion of a DIY society and what I call the myth of meritocracy that it's built on. And it also maintains a sort of moral boundary between the so-called deserving and undeserving poor. Other countries have essentially built their social safety nets on a more universal understanding of deservingness. The idea that there is a life with dignity that all people are inherently entitled to, regardless of what choices they happen to make or what circumstances they find themselves in. I mean, of course, the problem with that universal model, at least for the engineers and profiteers of our DIY society, is that it threatens their power. It forces them to pay more to protect those who can't afford protections on their own. It means higher taxes, especially on those at the top of the ladder. And it also has this other effect of reducing the kind of social inequality that serves as the basis of their power. So the more unequal our society is, financially unequal and status unequal, the more power those at the top wield, the more ability they have to force others into exploitation. And so they have an interest in maintaining this kind of inequality and getting people to buy into this idea that inequality is okay, or maybe even a good thing, because it reflects the deservingness of the people who fall at different spaces in this system. And so essentially, we might, in the absence of those kinds of myths, expect Americans in particular, those at the margins, those who maybe just earn a little bit too much to qualify for TANF or for food stamps or for other types of programs, to rebel and say, no, we need these protections too. We're also in a precarious situation. Expand these programs, you know, make them more available, get rid of these work requirements. But we don't, in part because the engineers and profiteers have been highly effective in quelling resistance by promoting these kinds of myths, myths like the myth of meritocracy, that create this sort of moral hierarchy around government support. So those who can get by without support are kind of at the top of the moral ladder. Those who need support but can prove their deservingness are kind of, you know, a little bit lower down. And those who can't or won't prove their deservingness fall at the bottom. Those who are sort of struggling and who, you know, for some reason or another are not taking these steps to show that they really deserve support. And so I think this moral hierarchy plays a key role in discouraging resistance to the kind of deeply inadequate and punitive social safety net that we currently have by essentially allowing anyone who isn't at the very bottom to kind of rest assured in the fact that at least they're a better person, quote unquote, than people who are lower on the ladder than them. So it encourages these divisions that often translate into racism, into classism, into sexism, and get us to focus on those divisions between us and to see them as the basis of deservingness, as opposed to focusing on how a stronger social safety net would actually leave us kind of society-wise in a better place overall.
Your answer reminds me of Wilkinson and Pickett's work on the spirit level and the fact that there are so many of these gradients in health outcomes and social trust and teen childbearing and all kinds of social problems that are reduced when we have lower levels of inequality within societies that actually benefit people across the spectrum. Now, they don't benefit the people at the very top as much as they benefit the people in the middle and towards the bottom. And so if you want to hold on to your higher levels of income and wealth and status, then yeah, you're not going to have an incentive necessarily to pay more in taxes, but you still get a benefit from that. And also you live in a more equal society where maybe you don't have to fear falling as much.
Exactly.
Especially for people who are like two and three notches who are down from the very, very top. So we're talking about, obviously, in our society, millions and millions of people and households.
Yes. Right?
I mean, it seems to me like because of the levels of inequality, we're getting, well, we already have a significantly entrenched underclass. And the function of that underclass, like Herb Gans said a long time ago, right, is to point at those folks and say, for those who are more in advantaged positions, like, you don't want to be that if you're looking at your son or daughter and saying, hey, you know, don't be like that person. So stay in school, kids, or make good choices, which is not going to alleviate those problems.
Yep. Though we're willing to accept it, you know, because it makes us feel better about ourselves, even as we're being hurt by the precarity that affects, as we talked about before, even those that, you know, relatively higher up on the system, that there is a better way. But it means sacrificing those kinds of relative advantages that we have over other people that can give us a sense of moral security, or it can also give us a sense of financial security, even relative to other people, and kind of focusing on giving yourself a leg up or giving your kids a leg up in the system, as opposed to trying to make the system fairer for all.
All right. Well, I'm tempted to go to college admissions right now, but let's steer away from that. We're going to get to some more implications of these high levels of inequality in a second. But you mentioned meritocracy. That's one of the myths that you cover in chapters 5, 6, and 7. The other two are the Mars and Venus myth and the supermom myth. And each of these support the DIY society, often trapping women. I was particularly struck in chapter 6 when you describe how increasingly progressive attitudes are not inevitable among young people, and that surveys show regressive views are resurgent, driven by Republicans and churchgoers. And in chapter 7, you profile an evangelical mother who puts her children's souls above all else, and a secular mom who sees competition everywhere in helping her children to be successful. Can you help us understand how these myths operate such that even secular, presumably progressive women are working hard in the absence of a robust safety net to secure their position, but also the position of their children?
Yeah, I mean, this gets back to that idea that we were talking about before, that the sort of allure of this notion that if you just make the right choices, if you just take the right steps, you and your family will be safe from precarity. And also, these myths kind of play two roles. One is to kind of promote that promise that if you just make these right choices, you'll be okay. And then the second piece is to justify the resulting inequalities, because the system doesn't really work. It doesn't really get us to a place where we're actually stable. And so we need things like we talked about before with the myth of meritocracy to make these inequalities seem justified. And the myth of meritocracy plays a key role in justifying race and class-based inequalities. And in similar ways, the myth of Mars and Venus operates to justify gender inequalities, even in the context of the family or in the context of workplaces, where it's easy, particularly for men, to buy into this notion. I profile in the book one dad who talks about how he perceives, at least, that his wife is just happier at home, that she quit her job when they had kids, even though when you talk to her, that's maybe not actually what's really going on, that she feels some pressure to be at home and would kind of like to go back to the workforce, but the job options open to her are not the best pay-wise. And so the reality is more complicated, but in his mind, he can tell himself, oh no, she's just happier at home. And so that becomes a way that he can justify what he actually talks about them as perks. And I talk about them in the book as sort of the perks of patriarchy, in the sense that he doesn't have to sacrifice his paid time off to stay home when the kids get sick. And he can afford to go to the gym after work because he knows his wife is making dinner. And so he benefits in a very real individual way from this system of exploitation and these kinds of myths about this idea that women are just naturally better at caregiving, that they're happier in these kinds of roles, allows him to feel okay with that, with those kinds of choices that he's made and that his family has made, even if his wife isn't particularly happy with the situation that they found themselves in. She was a social worker before they had kids. And so she was making about $30,000 a year, and he works in IT and he was making about $90,000. And so they could have afforded to pay for full-time childcare for her to keep working full-time, but he talked about it as it wouldn't make sense for her to spend half of her paycheck finding care. And so this was, I mean, he was clearly thinking about this as a direct trade-off between, you know, her income and their paying for childcare in a way that a lot of dads do, even when they could very easily chip in to help cover those costs out of their own salaries too. And so I think these myths help to, on the one hand, justify these kinds of inequalities, whether it's race and class inequalities or gender inequalities in our society. And then they also help to kind of make it seem as though we don't need a better safety net. That dad, for example, talked about how like he likes the idea of universal childcare in theory, but that he feels like his own kids are already getting a really high quality of support from his wife at home. And so it doesn't make sense to spend more money in taxes to pay for a system that would be a sort of poorer quality than what his kids are getting. And so it operates to sort of undermine support for this kind of, and he's a political independent. So he's not a Republican, but also not a Democrat. But he likes to think of himself as fairly egalitarian, fairly open to different ideas. And I think it suggests how these kinds of myths can operate to perpetuate this assumption that, yeah, we can, you know, maybe it would be great to have a better net in theory, but we don't really need one and we can get by without one. And in similar ways, the myth of the supermom, I talk about in the book how the core of this is the idea that women and particularly mothers are the ones who are the sort of natural protectors for children, or at least even if they're not the natural protectors, the buck is going to fall to them, in the sense that if no one else is there to protect their kids, it's ultimately up to them to protect them from threats. And so what that means then is that fear can be easily used to persuade mothers to step in, to sacrifice themselves, even if that means stepping out of the workforce or taking on a disproportionate share of the unpaid labor, when fear-based messaging tells them that kids are at risk. And I talk about in the book how the kinds of fear-mongering that happens around kids takes a number of different forms and can push mothers into this intensive protective type of mothering, to sort of see themselves as the superheroes that have to jump in and protect their kids. This can happen with religious types of messaging that present children as at risk from spiritual threats. This is often highly present in evangelical messaging, particularly evangelical parenting books that treat kids as sort of under attack spiritually from satanic forces in our society, whether that's public schooling or media or, you know, other types of things that they are CRT, things along those lines. And it can also take more secular forms, in the sense of mothers being warned about the threat of downward mobility, this idea that, oh, like if you don't send your kid to the right college or get your kid into the right preschool, even that they might not be able to reproduce the class status that you have, that they might not be able to have a stable, secure, happy life. And so, I mean, we can debate whether there's, you know, realities behind those different fears, but those fears are often what's driving mothers to feel like they can't just sit back and kind of let life play out for their kids, that they have to step in, they have to be more actively involved, even when that means doing a disproportionate share of the labor. And it kind of discourages them from trying to get other people involved in the effort of raising children, for example, because they worry about, you know, whether those other folks, whether that's childcare providers or teachers or even their partners, will do as good of a job in protecting kids from those kinds of threats.
This conversation about intensive parenting, intensive mothering in particular, we just saw in Louisiana some parents and a very organized, very tenacious group of folks in East Baton Rouge have decided they're going to create their own town and secede from Baton Rouge and creating a much, frankly, much whiter, much more affluent, independent city. I believe it's called St. George. And there's certainly a way you can talk about this as opportunity hoarding, of leaving behind a blacker, poorer city and really abandoning it and saying, like, these neighbors are no longer our neighbors.
Absolutely.
And this is not the only example of this, right? Certainly in my former state of Tennessee, Shelby County schools and the secession of some of the more affluent, whiter suburbs outside of the city of Memphis, this happened recently. And that kind of cycle supports the sense of precarity, no, well, in the sense, the fact of precarity, and it's a zero-sum mentality.
Yeah, very much so, in the sense that, I mean, I think they are recognizing that in the way that our public education, the way that our public education system is funded is to some extent, I mean, given the existing levels of funding, we could fight for more public funding. We could fight to fund all public schools to the level where they can provide a high quality education for all children and make sure that kids have their needs met, regardless of the kinds of challenges that they are facing outside of school. But in the absence of that kind of large public investment, I mean, I think on some level, it makes strategic sense for families to try to opportunity hoard, to say, what is the best way for me to get the best possible education for my kid, especially given these sort of the sort of fear that we live in of the possible threat of downward mobility for those who are already relatively high up on the social ladder. And so those families are saying, how do I do that strategically? And that might in some cases mean creating their own school district where they can set the rules about what their kids are exposed to, either message-wise or, resource-wise, in terms of being able to funnel the donation dollars that they're sending to a much smaller number of kids who look more like their own kids, and who might benefit in the process. And I think we have to think about how we've designed this DIY system in ways that encourage not only opportunity hoarding, but an amplification of inequalities in ways that kind of encourage those who are already relatively privileged to only make the rungs of the ladder further apart to protect themselves from the possibility of others following behind them and trying to pull them down.
All right, we could talk a lot more about that in terms of like wasted potential talent and futures and lives and creating an ever-expanding underclass of desperate folks who have limited options, let's say. But I want to talk about complaints. So many of the women you and your team spoke to were carrying heavy loads, childcare plus housework plus part-time work plus care work for themselves and their husbands. And despite this, your team noticed that women would often downplay valid criticisms of their partners. Why do you think this happens so often?
I mean, I think there's two things going on here. I think, one thing is that this is a problem of patriarchy and a problem of sort of systems of marginalization and oppression more generally, in the sense that within those deeply unequal systems, those who complain are, in most cases, like they're at risk of gaslighting. They're at risk of being told, oh, you're just complaining. You're just a nag. You're just, you don't realize how good you have it. And at worst, though, at risk of violence, at risk of, physical repression or social repression for trying to complain and trying to push back against that kind of system. So there's real risks involved in complaining in those kinds of ways. At the same time, I think there's also some complexity here, in the sense that women recognize that in some cases their partners do want to be more involved, but that they're up against pressures of their own. Talk about in the book in terms of things like ideal work norms that push workers and particularly men to invest as much as possible in their paid work and to sacrifice everything else, even if they would be happier spending more time with their kids, with their families, doing care work types of responsibilities. And so I think they understand on some level that men are up against those kinds of pressures too. And so they don't always know how to articulate it in those ways. But I think there's an understanding that the system is stacked in ways that encourage this kind of fighting between the genders and that encourage partners to focus on what they can get individually as opposed to coming together to try to secure the kind of support that would better help the family as a whole. And I think this gets back to the idea of like why the individualistic solutions are appealing, in the sense that to change that larger culture of work, to change that sort of culture of ideal worker norms and the pressures that we're facing under a capitalistic and highly exploitative system more generally, is often beyond individual couples' control, that there's only so much that they can do in the context of their own relationship. And so when men, and I think that kind of amplifies the first part of the problem, in that if men are up against these sort of norms on the one hand, then women simply telling their partners, do more, doesn't always solve the problem and can't always solve the problem. Especially, I think it's especially true for men who are in more precarious situations and who may not have, better options available and who may not have the flexibility or the time to provide more support. I think there's certainly men like the dad that I was talking about before who could definitely do more and who should arguably do more, who would be able to maybe not go to the gym every day after work, or maybe not, maybe take some days off to help instead of just saving those days for vacations or things along those lines. Or just doing a load of laundry every once in a while. And so I think there's kind of a range here in terms of partners who could very much be doing more. But then the problem on that front is that once a couple gets into a highly unequal situation like his, where one partner is at home doing almost all of the unpaid care work and doing almost all of the sort of household labor more generally, it becomes very hard for her to have any leverage to persuade him otherwise, because she's been out of the workforce for so long at this point that the options available to her are limited. And she's talked about it. Like, his wife, kind of, when I talked to her, talked about that in the sense of, like, she wants to go back to work, but she's actually not sure if going back to work would reduce the inequalities in her marriage, in part because those patterns have become so ingrained that it would be difficult to imagine her partner kind of taking on more of that responsibility, given how used to the perks of patriarchy he's gotten over time. And so for her, the idea of going back to a full-time paid position and also having to do all of the unpaid care work on top of that seems even more daunting. And so in that kind of a situation where you just feel like it's sort of hopeless, then not complaining sometimes just feels like the easiest solution, the way to sort of make it through the day or make it through your relationship, particularly in the context of the kind of pro-marriage messaging that we have in our society that tells couples that this is what you're supposed to be doing and you're supposed to be happy with this. So I think if these factors all kind of work together to create a system where women are often discouraged from complaining, both for the challenges that they know their partners are up against, for the personal risks they face in doing so, and because it often seems kind of hopeless, given the system that we're stacked up against.
It makes me think that, let's say this woman does go back into the labor force and that causes more strain in her marriage. And then let's say the marriage dissolves, right? Now you're perhaps a single parent. And so you have your job responsibilities and you have your caregiving responsibilities. Plus you've been out of the labor force. And so you are likely not making nearly what your former husband now is making. And so these are like cascading problematic effects that could come from renegotiating divisions of labor once they're set in a household.
And certainly, I mean, I think you can think about how, like, yes, she, and then so sometimes when I talk about this, people will say, but she'll get child support payments. And it's, well, not necessarily, depending on how custody arrangements are split. And also, even if that's the case, the costs of supporting two households in our economy are oftentimes very high, even for relatively privileged families. The idea of paying for full-time childcare, for paying for food, for paying for housing, I mean, these costs have only escalated in tremendous ways, particularly in the wake of recent inflation. And so we have to be sort of mindful of what's at risk, and why those kinds of financial risks of precarity and instability, and maybe having to the point before about school districts, maybe having to move school districts because you can't stay in that super affluent school district anymore because now you need two households instead of one. And how might the fear that plays into that discourage families from making those moves, from taking those steps to break out of marriages that are maybe less happy or deeply unequal? You know, there's lots of ways that the forces around them can push them to stay in those situations, even if they're not ideal.
All right. Well, towards the end of the book, you pull back a little bit and think about the implications of this DIY society and the increasing precarity and inequality that is the structure of our society. And you argue that the exploiting class actually prefers oligarchy to democracy. So one of the effects of having a growing proportion of our population being in such precarious situations, low wages, no safety net, difficulty in secure work, is that we also have disincentives to participating in political action and also just in asserting political voice. So those people who are at the top, the folks who are in the exploiting class, they don't want poorer people united and voting to tax them to the extent that they would have to pay for social democracy. So let's talk about more recent events. To what extent do you think recent labor movements and others are fighting to get the union of care that we deserve?
Yeah, I mean, I've been heartened to see the kinds of labor organizing that has happened over the past couple of years in terms of pushing back against the kind of exploitation that comes with a capitalist system. I think that kind of labor union organizing is deeply important. I'm not sure it will get us all the way to the kind of social safety net that we really need and deserve, in part because labor unionizing is often very focused on individual industries or even individual employers, and it doesn't often provide the kinds of connections across labor that are necessary to fight for these broader systems, to fight for the kinds of broader social policies that are going to be necessary to actually address some of the challenges that we're facing as a society right now. And so I think that's where I talk about in the book the need for not only sort of labor unions, but a union of care, where we're sort of centering on our shared participation in this project of caregiving, the fact that at some point in our lives, we will all need care, and at some point in our lives, realize we will all probably be called upon to provide care for others. And if we focus on that shared part of our identity, that's what unions are great about, is getting people to focus on a shared part of their identity and how policies or changes in structures can help them, you know, despite their differences, because of that shared part of our identity. And I think if we focus on care as a shared part of our identity, that can help us to think about what are the kinds of policies and practices that would support caregiving, that would support us both as care recipients and as caregivers in that kind of a system. And that means not only making things like certain types of care universal, child care, elder care, healthcare, for example, but also recognizing that not all care can be outsourced, that some care is always going to be informal, and that we can put in place policies that make it more possible for all of us to participate more actively and more sustainably in this shared project of care. So things like universal paid family leave, things like, you know, universal paid time off from work, things like protections for workers who take time off for caregiving reasons, or even stipends for families with dependents to give them more choice about how they allocate their time between paid work and care. That these kinds of policies recognize that care is just as valuable a part of our lives and our system as paid work, even when that work isn't part of the paid economy, because we can't possibly put all care work into the paid economy. And so we have to find other ways of valuing it and other ways of centering it in the collective work that we're doing. And so that's part of where I see both some hope on the organizing side of things, but then also a need to take things even further, to go beyond just a labor market model in terms of thinking about what it would take to fight collectively for this kind of social safety net we need.
I hear a lot of solidarity there, which I like. And also, I think it's kind of amazing that the research has been done, and we know that investments in young children have a great deal of benefit. I mean, monetarily, financially, economic development and growth and things like that. But just there's also the moral case, right? And the fact that we are, as you say, all recipients and givers of care, providers of care, different points in our lives. It's inescapable as part of our human condition.
And we could center care in those ways. Instead, we focus on other things. We focus on our economic productivity. We focus on our personal achievements, you know, but we could center care. We could value care in a way that recognizes its essentialness to all of us in our lives and in our relationships and in our communities, but we don't, because it doesn't fit the kind of economic and highly profitized model that we base our society on today.
Well, let's keep the imagination going and thinking about alternative ways to organize ourselves and importantly, move in that direction. Well, Holding It Together is a trade publication, and you have a lot of experience writing for and speaking to public audiences, in addition to your impressive record of academic books and peer-reviewed journal articles. I just said that the book is a trade book. It has a lot of lessons for academics too. This is not an airport book, although I'd be delighted to see it in airports, people reading it on planes for sure. But given all that, do you have any advice for academics who would like to reach public audiences with their work?
I mean, I would argue that this is a moment where we need public scholarship more than ever, in the sense that we've seen attacks on higher education from policymakers, from pundits. This is a time when American society is questioning the value of a college degree, the value of the academy. You know, what is the academy doing to young kids? This sort of a set of concerns that is in the ether right now. And so I think this is a moment where we as academics have a responsibility to share the results of our research in ways that are accessible for broad public audiences, to help them see the value of the work that we're doing and to understand the kinds of contributions that we can make with that work. And also the kinds of, you know, messages that, what are we teaching in our classes? They want to know. And so this is a way to give them a window into that, in the sense of these are the kinds of ideas, and to show them the evidentiary base that it's coming from, that these aren't just ideas pulled out of a hat or ideas pulled out of personal preferences, but instead these are ideas that are grounded in evidence and that are grounded in rigorous scholarship, and that can help us to cut through some of the noise that exists in our current media landscape. And so I think that's where I personally see a big role for scholars to play, and that there's risks involved with that. And I get why some folks shy away from sharing their work publicly, because of how that opens you up to criticism from pundits, from media folks, from policymakers, from people on Twitter. And I think at the same time, I do think that the more of us who are engaged in this work, the more that we can provide an example for each other of how to do this work sustainably and effectively in ways that focus on what are the core messages that we want to get across? How do we convey those in a way that is accurate and clear and engaging, and that people can translate into meaningful steps in their daily lives. Maybe not self-help types of steps, but steps in their daily lives in terms of, okay, if I wanted to get more involved, where should I turn? If I wanted to do more on this, what are the kinds of things that I could do? If I don't want to feel as guilty about this, you know, why should I not? These are the kinds of things, if we can help people see the relevance of research to their daily lives, if we can put it in a way that is not dumbing down to folks, but instead accessible, understanding that people often come to our books, to our op-eds, to our public writings with a fairly high level of knowledge and understanding of society that may just need a little bit of extra clarification or a little bit of extra evidence to support the kinds of conclusions that we're drawing. And so I think that's where we can play a key role as scholars in helping to show what academia can do, and also helping to use evidence to help people navigate the complicated misinformation landscape that we find ourselves in right now.
All right. Well, that's a great plug for the value of public scholarship and being clear and unmet when we're talking to public audiences. And also clarity is important when we're doing our own academic work for sociological audiences as well. All right. Well, Jess, I am so appreciative of you discussing your book. I wanted to turn to banter and some other topics that aren't related directly to the text, but this one actually is. You mentioned that you did some of this work in, you know, turning to the pandemic, and I understand you did a lot of phone calls and maybe Zooms and other kinds of things. What are your thoughts about the work environment that we're in now, where people are either Zooming in, or, I mean, some people have moved to different locations. You know, they move out of New York City, for example, and they've gone to some place with a mountain or something like that, and they Zoom in. What are your thoughts about the future of work, and is Zoom going to help us?
I mean, I think the remote work revolution is a bit of a double-edged sword in the sense that it, on the one hand, does offer an unprecedented level of flexibility and control for the people who have access to those kinds of resources and opportunities, which I think it's important to note is not everyone. There are always going to be jobs that cannot be done remotely. And so I think we have to be mindful of the kinds of inequalities that could potentially result from a system where the employees who are often the most highly paid are also the ones who now have oftentimes the most flexibility over their work environments, over how, you know, they can protect themselves from the kinds of physical stress or, you know, interactional stress, or just, you know, the logistical stress of having to commute to work and be on site every day in a way that other workers don't have that kind of flexibility for. At the same time, and kind of to that end, I think we also have to be mindful of what remote work can't do. One thing that I saw among families during the pandemic that we talked to was seeing remote work as a potential substitute for childcare in the midst of a childcare crisis. So right now we are in a situation where there are not enough childcare spots to go around for the families who need them, particularly spots for children, for very young children, for infants and young toddlers. And so there are many families who said, oh, I can work from home now. Like, now I don't actually need childcare. And many of them very quickly realized that it's not a substitute, that being able to work remotely, maybe when your infant is super tiny and sleeping all the time, but then you're also really tired all the time, like maybe that'll work for a few months. But the families who tried that often ended up really struggling, and oftentimes either with one partner dropping out of the workforce, usually mom, or going back to in-person, you know, having to find some other form of childcare to make it work instead, because it's not sustainable. That, you know, it's almost impossible to do a full-time paid job while also being a full-time caregiver for young children or for anyone else who needs full-time care in that kind of a way. And so I think we have to be mindful about how families may feel pressure to use this as a substitute for childcare, given the high costs and the lack of spots available for childcare, but also the limitations around that in terms of what it doesn't do. And similarly, I think we have to be careful about assuming that families will always use this in ways that will reduce inequalities. So I talked to, I think one of the saddest things that came out of the research that my team and I did for the book was the way that even in some couples where both partners were able to work from home at least part-time, in some of those cases, moms would actually encourage dads to go back to work in the office because dads were getting so angry at home. This was disproportionately, we did one of the national surveys that I did in addition to the interviews was in December of 2020. And we asked families about kind of how, or parents about how often they were yelling at their kids. And white dads with college degrees were sort of off the charts compared to everybody else in terms of their likelihood of saying that they were yelling at their kids once a day or more. And those were, I think it was something like 60% of those dads were saying that they were yelling at their kids at least every day compared to like 30 to 40% of everybody else. And the reason for that had a lot to do with the fact that these were disproportionately men who were able able to work remotely and who were often in that kind of full-time childcare situation for the first time. I talked to one mom, for example, who she and her husband, she was able to work from home full-time and her husband was able to work from home a couple days a week. And they had three kids, you know, two in elementary school and one toddler, and things were just chaotic at the beginning of the pandemic. And she talked about how the days that he was home, he would just get so angry. He was constantly yelling at the kids that she eventually told him, like, just stay at work. It's not worth having you here. Even though, I mean, it was at the same time taking, she talked about how she gained 40 pounds in 3 months, how she had to go back on antidepressants because she was so stressed out and how she was kind of drinking more heavily. Like, this was not easy for her, but she felt like she was the one who could protect her kids and did and could manage that anger, even when it was sort of eating away at herself in a way that her partner couldn't. And so it just made more sense to tell him to stay away, given the kind of emotional risk that she felt like that was putting her kids under. And so I think that kind of, we have to be careful about how we sort of treat kind of who is going to take advantage of these opportunities, what is it substituting for, and how might it potentially discourage us from investing in the kinds of systems like universal childcare that could help to make sure that families have the support that they need.
That's a really harrowing story about those dads that are yelling at their kids a lot more. I was thinking about your first point in terms of the unequal effects of some workers working at home and others not able to. I mean, here in Huntsville, we have this pretty large military installation called Redstone. And one of the things that's happened post-pandemic is that many of them are now working at home. And it's caused some businesses near the arsenal to actually close, like restaurants, like places where people would go for lunch when they were on base. But then I thought about, well, what happens when higher proportions of like office workers stay home, right? So the salad place that's on the corner, or the shoe repair place, or the tailor, the alterations place, you know, all these businesses that rely on large numbers of workers that are concentrated, that do errands and other things for either before work or during their lunch break and things like that, are all potentially impacted by the increase in remote work and the lack of need or less need for these sort of routine life maintenance things that office workers need.
Yeah. And I mean, I would personally say that that's not necessarily a reason to push people back into the office to sustain the local economy. I think instead, if anything, it suggests that there's a need for taking care of people, regardless of how the economy changes around them. That oftentimes we treat people as cogs in a machine, that, you know, when the economy is booming, we put in place whatever policies or changes are necessary to push them back into the workforce because we need them there. And then when the economy is struggling, we take away those supports and kind of encourage people to drop out or go back home. And so I think, you know, right now we treat people as these cogs in this giant mechanism of capitalism, instead of saying, okay, how do we make sure that all people have what they need to live a life with dignity, whether they're getting that support from paid work or not, especially in a moment where the life world of work is shifting in such dramatic ways and in ways that may make it difficult for people to find opportunities for solid employment where they are locally without having to sort of move across state lines or across city lines and can kind of stay within those communities where they've already built their homes.
Throughout this conversation, I keep thinking about rural places because my grandparents are from, they passed now, but they're from a very rural part of southern Missouri. And if you look at the census maps in the state of Missouri, which is a state I know relatively well, the counties that are growing are the metropolitan ones and those adjacent to major cities. And essentially the northern quarter of the state of Missouri, if you draw a line from St. Louis to Kansas City, folks north of that line, those counties lost population. If you draw a line south of Columbia, basically, many of those counties lost population. And so, you know, work has disappeared, populations have disappeared, childcare responsibilities haven't gone away for those who remain. But all that to say, we tend to essentially individualize that responsibility for those people who are left behind. And we say, like, go to coding camp or do something that is going to invest in your own individual merit, so to speak, or human capital, instead of saying individuals aren't responsible for macro level changes in the structure of the economy. And so therefore we need a systemic social solution to this that doesn't rely on folks either taking out debt, which is how many people get their education today, or moving to a major city, St. Louis, Kansas City, other places in order to make a living, even though those places are more expensive than, let's say, Ozark County, Missouri.
Yeah. And it gets back to this idea of the DIY society and kind of the mythicalness of that, and that we tell people that, oh, you should just be able to figure it out. You know, if you just make the right choices, pick the right college major, if you, you know, go to the right college, if you live in the right community, you'll be fine. When in reality, the landscape is constantly shifting around them in ways that people can't easily respond to, especially people with limited resources, limited economic resources, that aren't always able to make those choices as rapidly as they would need to. And so then it becomes easy to just justify underinvesting in those communities. And I think this is where, you know, this DIY myth becomes so pernicious, in the sense that it not only puts more onus on people to navigate this as individuals, but allows us to sort of feel morally secure as a society and just saying, oh, well, too bad, you know, things change. You didn't pack up and move. You didn't make those right choices. You should have done something differently 20 years ago when you didn't even know that you would have to. And so I think it's a shame, unfortunately, given the way that it leads us to treat, you know, our fellow citizens and our you know, people in our communities and people in nearby communities who haven't had the same privileges and opportunities by those who maybe have had that chance to move or to make those quote unquote good choices in their own lives.
All right. Well, Jess, one more question for you. You're a sociologist of childhood, and often in the public media and conversations, we hear that young people don't know what they're talking about, particularly when it comes to political engagement or topics of the day. How do you respond as someone who studies young people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that the young people today, as we've seen with some of the political activism that's happening on college campuses, for example, are, you know, highly informed, that they're taking steps to come to this activism from a place of deep concern about, and oftentimes deep knowledge of, what is happening in other parts of the world, a willingness to think beyond their kind of own personal experiences and care about others. And that's oftentimes what, you know, what we hope for them out of education, is that kind of willingness to think critically, that willingness to think kind of beyond their own entitled self-interests. And so I think that, you know, if anything, in that sense, we should be mindful of this current moment as evidence that, you know, kids are all right on some level, in the sense that they care, and that they are thinking about the world in critical ways, you know, that they may, you know, that there may be missteps along the way. But at the same time, I think that's true of all of us, mm-hmm. and that we can all, you know, learn from the example of being willing to take steps to address something that is important, and to think beyond ourselves, and to try to work together collectively to push for larger solutions to big social problems that we can't address on our own.
Well, kids are all right. You heard it here. The students that I have here at University of Alabama in Huntsville are often extremely bright, very curious, definitely want to be able to use their education for something more than just their own individual career aspirations. And they recognize that their concerns and their lives are linked to the lives of others. And so they have a great deal of concern for the state of the world. They're looking to their faculty members often to provide them with readings and resources that help them make sense of the challenges that we're facing right now. So I'm glad to hear.
And I think another thing to point to is like this idea that I think young people often recognize in a way that adults don't, that rules have a certain arbitrariness to them, in the sense that, you know, rules are socially, they understand social construction often at an internal level, that we as adults, we've been so kind of jaded by being in the world for so long that we see these things as fixed and immutable. And certainly like research on very young kids, preschoolers and toddlers, I mean, they're super creative with how they engage with the world. They see possibility everywhere. And so I think that, you know, can give us hope too, in the sense that they recognize that the kinds of rules, some of my other research looks at kind of the inequalities around how institutions enforce rules. And I think young people often recognize that, okay, but we could change those rules. You know, we could change the kinds of systems, we could change the laws, we could change the norms, and see those things as less fixed than adults might. And so I think that can also be a useful reminder to sociologists, that, you know, the social construction is real, in the sense that, and the implications of that, and then also for the broader society in terms of what it suggests about what's possible.
All right. Are you saying another world is possible?
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I think that's a good way to end it.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, Dr. Jessica Clarko, thanks so much for joining us. The book Holding It Together is an engaging read. It is harrowing at times. You get a great portrait of the DIY society and the strains that it imposes on women right now, and hopefully some of the tools in thinking about ways that we can make things better for all of us. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It was great to chat with you.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Jessica Clarko of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks also to our producer and to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab. Music by Alina Warsaw.